This is Money, brought to you in partnership with MS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with MS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to round up this week's top stories that they've been covering on their financial website of the year. And is the dust starting to settle, we're asking, on post-Brexit vote Britain?
Petrol prices, wine, food prices, and they're all indications of that we're just starting to see the beginning of the pass-through.
We got a swathe of pre- and post-referendum figures this week: employment, inflation, retail, house prices. But what is the picture telling us? Well, if you're a saver, it's not pretty. It may be a gold rush in Rio, but wooden spoons all round for Santander 123 current account holders, made famous, of course, by a host of sporting stars.
Jessica!
Hi!
I switched to the Santander 123 current account. Now I get 3% interest on balances between £3,000 and £20,000, up to 3% cash back.
Not anymore, Jessica, Ennis Hill, Olympic champ there, of course. You only get 1.5% now. The bank slashes its rate in half, blaming the Bank of England rate cut. So is it time to ditch and switch, or will Santander still be the best option for you? Savings rates aren't the only things, though, to drop. Annuity rates continue to plummet, just as there are warnings some people using the new pension freedoms may be taking too much too fast from their pots.
The key thing is, for anyone coming up to retirement and you're really having to start thinking about how you're going to fund your life once you stop working, it's get some decent financial advice.
It's not all about cuts this week, though. Up went how much stuff we're buying. That's despite hearing the stuff we're buying has actually gone up in price. Inflation rose slightly, which meant so too rail fares will go up. And Lee gets angry. Also, no change to house prices. But where are they going up the most? Luton and Slough, we're hearing.
Come, friendly bombs, and fall on Slough. It isn't fit for humans now.
Conspicuous in their absence, though somewhat surprisingly, are those two towns from the latest poll looking at the happiest places to live in the UK. And where is it that the sun shines every day from the smiles on the residents' faces?
Oh, I do like to be beside the seaside. Oh, I do like to be beside the sea.
Yes, Mr. Lee on Sea Boyce waxes lyrical on life in his home county. But we are asking today, if you could live anywhere in the UK, where would it be? A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Lee. Simon, to you first. If you could live anywhere in the UK, where would it be?
I quite fancy living by the seaside. I think that would be nice. Mm. It would be nice to live somewhere like Cornwall or Devon, or even in, you know, Wales near the Gower Peninsula.
The commute would be a nightmare.
The commute would be a nightmare. So if I still had to come into London to go to work, I'd like to live in a nice big house with a big long garden that goes down to the River Thames, somewhere up near that sort of Henley up to Oxford stretch. And I'd have a boat that I'd keep at the end of my garden, and I'd come home from work on a sunny summer's evening and I'd go messing around on boats.
Oh, sounds delightful.
And swimming in the river too.
Be careful about that one. Lee, you?
Well, it's difficult this, Georgie, because I already live pretty much near number one in that list.
All right, show off.
We're going to talk about it later. But I think if I had to choose, I would definitely choose either North Devon. Absolutely beautiful around there. Sweeping sea views. Wonderful one-tap beaches as well. Lots of sort of untouristy beaches. And also, I recently went to the Peak District. It's absolutely lovely up there. The little town of Bakewell. I could get my little Bakewell tarts. And this is more like retirement times, but I can imagine myself there.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Weekdays from 9 till 12. Wants your feedback. Contact the programme by tweeting at Share Radio UK. Text 66777 and start the text with the word share. Or email consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. If it's about money and it matters to you, it matters to us.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio. The team from the financial website of the year, This Is Money, are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with MS&I. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to go through some of the stories they've been looking at this week. Now, remember, Simon and Lee, that a few weeks ago I dared to suggest that the dust might be settling on post-Brexit vote Britain, and a listener quite rightly pointed out that the dust could still be seen from space. So this week we got inflation, house prices, employment, retail figures. Could I dare to be so bold as to try again? It's not just me saying this. Here's Pete Cumley, author of Inflation Matter.
We're starting to see the first signs of the impact of Brexit's devaluation of sterling. Petrol prices, wine, the fact that food prices did not decline as much last month as they had in the past, and they're all indications of that we're just starting to see the beginning of the pass-through of the increase in prices. And the interesting one is, rather than the inflation report, was the producer prices index report, because that shows for the first time in 2 years actually a positive increase in prices from the factory gate. But more importantly, I think the input prices to producers went up 4.3% in July. For the previous couple of years, they've always been in negative territory, so this is a big jump.
So have we got any clearer picture of where we are and where we are heading? Well, savers got a big sign this week, and it is not pretty. Cuts to saving accounts have come thick and fast over the years, and they show no signs of letting up. In this low interest rate environment, the advice was, wasn't it, to check out current accounts. Now, millions took that advice. They headed in their droves to Santander's innovative 123 account, made famous, of course, by a host of top sporting stars. Well, those customers got their first taste of disappointment at the start of the year, raise in the monthly fee from £2 to £5, and now the bank says that it's slashing interest rates in half to 1.5%. So the question is now, do you ditch your account in protest for a rival, or will Santander still be the best option for you? Really, just remind us, why was this account so popular, so innovative?
So when it launched in 2012, it really was, you know, the first to start offering quite a hefty interest rate on balances, and up to £20,000 as well. So it was very generous. You'd earn 3% between £3,000 and £20,000 if you held it in your bank account. It originally came with a £2 monthly fee, which people kind of said, wow, it's only £2 a month, I'm getting good interest. And also a range of cashback offers, so you get up to 3% on a range of bills, so your utility bills, for example, or your council tax. So it really blew open the current account market. And at the same time, the 7-day switching rules came in. It was almost like a perfect storm for Santander. They'd launched this sort of innovative account. Lots of people had the same bank account that they've had, you know, for decades. There's a lot of inertia when it comes to current account switching. So people were actually going, well, this might be worth my while to switch to. And that's what happened. People switched to it in their droves. Millions of people have opened this account. It has been just such a massive, massive winner for Santander.
So what is happening? What are the changes coming
well,
in?
Well, last month we kind of revealed that Santander were looking at cutting the rate. We thought it was actually going to be to 2%, a flat rate of 2% all the way up to £20,000. What actually happened, transpired this week, is that Santander went a little bit further than that, perhaps prompted by the Bank of England base rate cut earlier in the month, and it's now going to be 1.5% up to £20,000. So those that have got quite big sums in there are going to be getting a big dent in their interest. And of course, you know, with savings rates, traditional savings rates dropping like flies elsewhere, the question is, where else can you get that kind of return? The answer is nowhere.
Well, that's it, isn't it? So is it better to stick or to twist? Interestingly, they're sort of suggesting it's the Bank of England cut, but also, of course, they had the QE and their money printing, as it were, and lending to banks. Has that perhaps impacted that the banks don't need us for our money so much? They don't have to offer such great rates?
That's exactly in a nutshell, Georgie, to be quite honest with you. If you think about it, in 2012, when they launched this account with a 3% rate, although that was a good rate at the time, as time has gone on, it's looked more and more generous. So actually, to be fair to Santander, you know, I'm surprised this cut hasn't come sooner. It's disappointing for existing customers who would have switched to the lure of this interest, particularly if you switched to it in the last 12 months, because you haven't, you know, made the most of having that 3% rate. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's a bank, it's there to make money. If it's finding it's too expensive to run that account, then it's going to have to start cutting interest, and that's what it's done. Is it fair on customers? Well, I don't believe so, but people have, if you've opened that 4 years ago, you've got a pretty decent return on that current account.
Well, the fact is, with this, with the fee that you'll have to pay, you have to do the maths to work out whether it's worthwhile. But in terms of if you decide to stay or you decide to go, it might be a good idea to hold off, because you don't know if other banks are going to follow suit. So again, where would you go?
Well, that's right. So a number of banks that we've contacted this week who offer rates on their on balances for customers have actually turned around and said there's no immediate plans to make any cuts, but yeah, there's no immediate plans. But one that has come out and said actually our current accounts are under review is Lloyds in Halifax. So Lloyds offers 4% on its Club Lloyds account, which has been very popular because that offers 4% up to £5,000. So for those people that have between £0 and £5,000, it's actually probably a better account than a Santander 123 account anyway. Yeah. And it's yeah, it turned around and told us this week that these rates are under review because of, you know, market conditions, probably not helped by the fact that Santander's dropped its rate. And I wouldn't be surprised in the coming months if more and more start looking at cutting rates. Andrew Hager of Moneycoms actually told me this week that he believes more rates will be cut from current accounts, largely because banks' profit margins are being squeezed, particularly with SVR cuts coming in, so standard variable rate mortgage cuts coming in the 1st of September, passing on that Bank of England base rate cut. It's going to squeeze profits more. So that could mean that some of these accounts are just too generous now. Yeah. Banks are turning around and going, do you know what, let's reduce this rate.
And we've had you on in the past, and I did mention there earlier that the advice if you want to get something from your savings was current accounts. I mean, if you're just taking a look here, the top easy access rate in the This Is Money's independent saving tables from RCI Bank currently pays just 1.2%. Is the advice perhaps still that these current accounts, even if they cut their rates, because obviously 1.5 is better than 1.2%, is better to go here?
Exactly. Well, it is all about sort of crunching the figures, looking at how much you keep in a current account, what works best for you. But as you've pointed out there, easy access rates are dropping like stones. You look at the best buy rates from the big players on the high street, some of them offering 0.1% easy access rates. Absolutely scandalous. No one's going to want to take that out. But running out of options. Savers are running out of options. So it's massively disappointing. It's had negative press this week, Santa, obviously, cutting that rate. But as you say, as you rightly point out, it's still better than the easy access rate. So it's a real sort of head, you know, head turner, this, because I don't know. There's so much going on, you don't quite know. And that's the trouble savers have at the moment. Where do you put your cash, especially if you've got big sums?
Well, absolutely. We keep talking about a saving crisis. We'll get on to Simon in a sec. Don't worry, I've not forgotten about you. Simon's been writing about just this thing. But I want to ask you, we talk about a savings crisis. It doesn't help, does it, to encourage us to save when you have things like this?
It doesn't. I have so many friends that, you know, come up to me and say, I've got a bit of cash or I want to start saving, even if it's £50 a month to start putting away. And then I tell them what rates are on offer and they go, oh, what's the point of that? You know, if you're putting away £100 a month, you know, and over the year you end up with £2 interest, people just aren't interested, you know, rather than spend for the here and now. Until there's some sort of like way that people are going to get a better return of interest, especially for those that are first starting out saving or want to start saving, I just can't see us becoming a nation of savers until the situation changes.
So, I mean, your solution to that, do you think? Is this making it worse for us to encourage saving?
Yes, it does. I think seeing some form of return on your savings definitely encourages people to save. I think that if you're starting out saving, though, the greatest benefit that you get from saving is just the accumulation of your own money. It takes you quite a long time to actually see any meaningful amount of interest. Even if you're getting a 5% interest rate, it'll take you a long time to see any meaningful amount. But what you will see is the fact that if you get £100 out of your month, out of your account every month, at the end of a year, you'll have £1,200 and you can give yourself a big pat on the back. Yeah. And it looks like a really nice big figure in a savings account. I think the killer thing, like with the Santander 123 account, the reason why this was so popular amongst our interest hunting current account openers, of which there's a big chunk out there, we've seen a really big rise in the number of people using This Is Money as a starting point to open current accounts in the last couple of years. Now, you could say, I'm sure the architects of the 7-day switching thing would say, well, that's because our 7-day switching is working, or that's because we're customer apathy, we're finally cutting through it. I don't think it is. I think it's savers basically going, right, I've given up on savings accounts, so I'm going to try and get a return on my money wherever I can. So, and if you look at the accounts that people are opening, they're really liking these high interest paying accounts. But the Santander one was a real winner because it combined this sort of cashback element as well. And then you had to look at that and go, well, does that cover the fee that I'm paying? Because you do have to pay a fee for the account. But also because it combined the 3% rate with a £20,000 maximum. And it was that good rate and big maximum that paid off. The other ones that pay high rates, they've got much lower maximums. But you have to ask yourself, you know, why are the banks offering these accounts? What's going on here?
Well, you call it the high interest current account trick was good while it lasted, but don't give up on it just yet.
Yeah, so banks have been eager to pull in these customers for a number of reasons. Firstly, growing market share is generally seen as a good thing, even if what you're doing it with is essentially a loss leader. You know, think of like the supermarket selling loss leaders. This is what these things theoretically are. They cost the bank money. Secondly, there's this thing that enough people fall foul of the rules, or they don't move their money, or they misjudge the fees versus rewards calculation, that the accounts just aren't as expensive as they could be for the banks. And then finally, you've got to look at the fact that a current account is the best marketing tool that your bank has got. Too many of us still basically just take out whatever product with our bank. You know, we just go, oh, well, I'll just use my bank's savings account. You just take out my bank's loan. I'll just take out my bank's mortgage. So they get to sell you higher margin products. And even in these days when they can't rip you off for PPI or flog you a structured product that's pretending to be a savings account or do all these other things that they used to earn fat commissions on, current accounts are still a great marketing tool. And if you look at a bank's figures, they've got this thing called the net interest margin. And that is the money that they make between the cost of getting money in and what they get from lending it out. And because interest rates have fallen, they've had this big pressure to cut their standard variable rates on mortgages. They're cutting mortgage rates. That's putting, you know, pressure on that net interest margin. And if they keep offering these accounts with these high rates and they've got lots of customers on them, then it's going to eat into that and that's not going to look good. And that's the key to why this is happening. So if you want to move, then you've got to ask yourself, who's least likely to cut? I think Nationwide, they pay 5%, but that's only for 1 year. Mm-hmm. So it's on a limited amount, but a reasonable amount, but it's only for 1 year. So they're not that much on the hook. And Nationwide makes a ton of money. It is making huge profits at the moment. They can continue with that one. TSB likes to say it's a challenger bank, despite the fact that it's been around since 18-something. Now owned by the Spanish. That is definitely a bank that wants to continue building market share. So I think that they could probably continue on with this, their loss leader, for a while. Tesco as well. Tesco Bank still wants to build market share. Basically has said that it wants to pull in a load more current account customers. Again, I think probably their rate might be safe. But yeah, I mean, you look at Lloyds. Well, does Lloyds really need to still build current account share? It's got an awful lot of customers. Mm. I mean, at one point it was trying to sell some of them off because it had been told to. So I think maybe that one is at risk. And again, then you've got the Halifax Reward current account that pays £5 a month rather than an interest rate. So that is limited. You can get your £60 a year off the back of it, but they'll give you free money for joining. So I think that we will see these become less generous than they have been, but I still think they're worth using because you're getting a return on your cash that's better than a savings account.
And also, as you mentioned there, and you mentioned last week, the banks are chucking money at you to come join them.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, I don't have one of these accounts. Mm. I don't have a high interest paying current account, but I do have an offset mortgage with First Direct. So any money I leave in my current account or my savings account with First Direct is linked to my mortgage, and I only pay interest on the balance between the two, basically between the mortgage amount and the amount of money I've got in my account. So I know that any money I leave sat in those accounts is earning a return, which the equivalent return at the moment is 2.5%. Mm. And it's like this great peace of mind of knowing that even though you are an inertia prone, lazy customer who doesn't move their money into their savings account when they're meant to, doesn't put it in their investment account when they're meant to, accidentally leaves too much money in their current account, and all those other things, that you are earning a return on it. And a high interest account will do the equivalent of that.
What's the answer to that, Simon? We blame banks a lot for things. We blame the government, but actually a lot of the blame has to fall on our own inertia, our own apathy to a certain extent. Is there anything that banks, that the government, that policy can do to combat that?
I think that if you look at it at the most base level, people in general, if you look at, you know, behavioural economics, people are stupid and lazy. Mm. And banks and other companies are there to make money and profit. And the easiest way for them to profit is by targeting people's stupidity and laziness. So as an individual, the key to stopping people making as much money as they can from you is to be less stupid and less lazy. And then you've got this whole thing where they want to shake up banking and make banks compete more. We talked about this last week. Is it going to happen? I think the thing that will really change that is going to be the arrival of lots more banks, digital banks, you know, a new wave of banking coming in. I'm not sure that we can rely on what have been the big banks for the last however many decades to be the ones that really shake up banking.
So challenges like TSB, Simon?
Maybe challenges like TSB, yeah. Or people like, you know, Atom or even a Tesco of this world, or what's the other one that I can never remember the name of? Tandem.
Yeah. We got there in the end. Now, savings rates aren't the only things to be slashed. Annuity rates have seen some sharp falls recently amid the economic uncertainty surrounding Britain's EU membership referendum in June. Experts warning the recent cut in the Bank of England base rate to 0.25% will be a further blow to pensions. Aviva, Legal & General, LV and Just Retirement all axe the top deals for new customers who want to turn their pensions into an income for life. Now, this may encourage more people to take advantage of the new pension freedoms introduced last year, of course, but there are warnings we're hearing this week that some may be plundering too much from their retirement pots too soon. The Association of British Insurers says a small minority may be withdrawing at a rate that sees their money run out in a decade or less. Here's financial expert Hannah Maundrell.
It does paint a very worrying picture for people that are coming up to retirement. We did some research ourselves and found that most people aren't willing to pay for financial advice when it comes to their pension and what they should do in retirement and how to fund it. And that's a problem that the regulator, the FCA, really knows about, and it's actually conducting a review into financial advice and how people are accessing it. I think the key thing is for anyone that is coming up to retirement, or even if it's on the horizon and you're really having to start thinking about how you're going to fund your life once you stop working, it's get some decent financial advice. And that means going to PensionWise, first of all, but that's only going to give you an understanding of your options. It's probably going to be worth speaking to a qualified advisor about this. And I think the regulators acknowledge that by saying that it is most likely going to let people take money out of their pension schemes to then pay for that advice. And that should come in the next couple of years.
Firstly, Simon, why have we been seeing annuity rates fall?
The reason why annuity rates have fallen, you have to look back over a number of years, and you can trace it to two things. Firstly, annuities tend to be priced off gilts, government bonds, UK government bonds, heavily influence annuity rates. And an annuity is a product that will provide you with an income for the rest of your life. And basically, the insurer that provides you with that product uses gilts, uses government bonds as in order to do that. Now, we've got low interest rates, super low interest rate environment, which has pushed down gilts. But then we've also got quantitative easing. And the longer that people think interest rates are going to stay low for, and the more of those government bonds that the Bank of England goes and buys up and pushes up the price of them and pushes down the yield, the lower the yield falls on gilts. And that then impacts annuity rates. And they were already pretty low. And as we got to lower for longer than you could ever even dare to think about interest rates, they fell even lower. And then we had the Bank of England come out a couple of weeks back and announce that it was going to cut interest rates, that it was going to indulge in a bit more QE. And that sent them tumbling again. So basically, annuity rates look awful at the moment.
So the advice?
It's really tough. If you're retiring now and you've got a pension pot that you need to turn into an income for the rest of your life, then you've got a really difficult choice. Do you take the security of an annuity so that you don't have to worry about generating that income yourself from investments,
but with terrible rates,
and take that terrible rate? Do you think that rates are so bad now that even though you're going to take an annuity, you might wait and hope they get better in the future? Or could they get even worse? It is a super tough choice, and I don't envy anyone taking it. The other option is you keep your money invested and you draw an income from that. And if you look at the yield, you know, the natural yield on the stock market of 4% at the moment, you look at what an income investment trust would pay you of around 4% or something like that, that looks an awful lot more attractive than a poor paying annuity rate, but you are taking the risk that your investments will fall in value.
So the Association of British Insurers have been taking a look at some of the numbers, and what have they found? They're slightly worried that a small minority may be withdrawing just too much too soon as a result of these new pension freedoms. Do we have enough detail here to give us a clear picture?
I think that the issue is there was this classic you know, Steve Webb's Lamborghini line, wasn't it? We're relaxed about people blowing it on a Lamborghini because the new flat rate state pension is going to be much better. As the new flat rate state pension arrived, for a lot of people, they discovered it wasn't quite as much better as they thought it was going to be, if that syntax is correct in any way, form or manner. But the thing is like, it's not just people taking all the money out of their pension to buy a Lamborghini or a secondhand Mazda MX-5 or even go on a holiday. It's also this really difficult thing where if you keep your pension invested and it's going to provide you with an income for the rest of your life, it's really hard to work out how much money you can afford to take out of it. Because if you're lucky, you can just invest it and spend the income from your investment. But most people can't do that. They need to spend a bit of the capital as well. So then there's the how much of it is it safe to spend every year? And there's a lot of debate about what the figure is on that.
Well, just taking a look at some of the figures here, the ABI saying the vast majority of savers appear to be taking a sensible approach. More than half of pots where money was withdrawn involved less than 1% of the total value being taken out, while some 45,641 pots had less than 1% withdrawn from them. They also added 4% of pots where withdrawals were made amounting to 3,379 had 10% or more of the value taken out. But bear in mind, some of these pots may be very... very small. Lee, are you concerned?
Not particularly. I think these figures actually have completely debunked the myth that everyone was going to go and blow, you know, their money on a Lamborghini. You know, drilling into the figures of this, they reckon that at least 57% of people that have taken money out has been for sensible sums. So, I mean, that's pretty promising, isn't it, from the start? I mean, the worrying figure is, at the end of the spectrum, 4.2% were for sums greater than 10%. But, as you say, it depends on how big the pot was. You know, if someone's got an absolutely huge pot, then maybe it's not so much of a problem. But what financial advisors recommend is that withdrawals should be below 4% just to prevent any sort of dangerous capital depreciation or, you know, and to make your money last for what they say is like 30 years, which is probably going to be how long you've got to live. But, I mean, it's a bit of a morbid topic, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you don't know what's going to happen
in the
future.
Well, it's reality, isn't it?
And there's so much to think about and so much to balance when you come to that making that decision.
Well, you touched on it there with financial advisors. I think the figure I heard was something like 17% had actually taken financial advice about this. Now, that's probably a worrying figure, isn't it? I mean, they've got the free PensionWise service. That is not financial advice. Again, it's that question of why are people not getting advice over something so fundamentally important and actually very difficult, I'd imagine?
Because they don't want to pay for it.
There we go.
It's the simple answer. Look, we get this all the time from our readers. They say, I don't want to pay a grand. I don't want to pay £2,000 for someone to do this. And if your pension pot is £30,000, and it's going to cost you £2,000 to get some financial advice, that's quite a big chunk of your pension pot. We've written about this before. There's a value to it, and you will almost certainly manage to get back more from the financial advice than the financial advice costs you. And I do genuinely think that it is worth doing. And we talked about this a while back. I changed my mind on this. I used to think, well, look, and like a lot of our readers and a lot of our listeners will think, look, I can just put my money in an investment account and draw the money off it. You know, this is simple. I don't need to pay some guy £1,000 or £2,000 to tell me this, you know. But there's a lot more to think about it than that. It is to do with the how much can I afford to take out. And, you know, that 4% is used as a benchmark. But some people say that now in this, you know, low interest rate, low return, low growth environment, maybe it's closer to 2 or 3. Other people say, well, look, you should front load some of your spending. Enjoy it while you can, because, you know, if you live to 95, chances are after the age of 85, you're going to stop doing a lot of stuff and you will need less money. And then there's other things like the cost of potential cost of long term care. And there's also the risk that what people do is the opposite to what we're talking about here. And they don't spend enough money, that they sit there with their pension pot and they don't spend it and they don't enjoy their retirement and then they die. And then obviously, you know, their pension pot gets passed on. But I think that were you to ask many people, would you rather that your parents or your grandparents enjoyed their retirement, or would you rather that they scrimped and saved and then left you as much money? They'd say, I'd like them to enjoy their retirement. And I think a good financial advisor will also tell you to do that.
Editor Simon Lambert, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
Now, it's not all about cuts this week. No, we got some raises as well. pretty unwelcome ones too. We're still hitting the high street pretty hard, we're hearing, and that's in the wake of inflation figures. So how much stuff is costing? They are also up, and in turn that means rail fares are going up as well. Paul Novak is from the UK's National Trade Union Centre, the TUC.
Passengers are getting a raw deal from Britain's railways. Fares have risen twice as fast as wages since 2010. And at the same time, dividends to the shareholders of the privatised train companies have spiralled. So they went up by 20%, over 20% last year alone to £220 million. So we think passengers aren't getting a fair deal. Taxpayers aren't getting a fair deal, and the only people winning from Britain's privatised railways are the private train companies.
Now, it's all linked to something called the RPI. That went up 1.9% in July, up from 1.6% in June, according to the Office for National Statistics. Here's Ed Bowsher, Shares senior analyst, with a quick reminder on how CPI and RPI work.
So the CPI, that stands for Consumer Price Index, and it's a way of measuring inflation. So the statisticians, they look at a range of different products and see how much their price rises over a year, and then they say, hey presto, the CPI has risen by 1%, that's inflation. The RPI, the Retail Price Index, very similar, but it's calculated in a different way, and it also includes housing costs, things like mortgage interest payments, which aren't included in the CPI. So normally, the RPI, the Retail Index, is higher than the CPI, the consumer index.
So Lee, before you go all misty-eyed as a representative of Essex Tourist Board, it is time to clear your lungs a bit more. You are not happy about rail fares in particular going up. So your time, Lee, starts now.
Well, I think it's an absolute disgrace that year on year, rail prices go up without any kind of, you know, thought process behind it. It just seems like, I mean, it's more reliable than the actual train system here. You know it's going to be on time every year. There's going to be a rise and it's going to be linked to RPI.
Why? Why that link?
Well, exactly. Why? Why is it linked to RPI? It makes no sense. You know, if it was linked to CPI, we'd be seeing 0.6% train fare rises next year. It's still not pleasant, but still a lot more easier pill to swallow when you consider that the service isn't getting any better. I've been commuting for a long time now. My train carriages aren't getting any nicer. If anything, they look like they're still from the 1970s. There's still delays. There's still overcrowding. You know, why is my train fare going to be £100 more expensive a year from January? Where's it going? What's it doing? You know, is it really being reinvested into my service? No, I don't think it is.
It really has been a summer of discontent, hasn't it? Summer, a spring, a winter, an autumn for Southern Rail customers. But it has been a really tough time in terms of strikes, particularly.
I feel so sorry for anyone that uses Southern. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. I think that my train operator's bad, and it has been bad over the years. But, you know, as I say in my column this week, you know, I've got a bit of a zen-like approach now to train travel. I make sure that I don't get too upset about delays. If there's delays, I'll just go to the pub. You know, I just really just kind of
get some classical music.
Yeah, obviously that's okay for me. But if meditation. If I had a family, it's awful because, you know, Southern customers, a lot of people can't even get home to tuck their kids in at night. I think it's actually quite heartbreaking. It's really quite sad. And these strikes have just been the worst. This is actually a crisis, and the government knows this is a crisis. There's a lot of people that commute up from that on that Southern line. It's affecting even house prices around there because people are being put off living there because the train line's so bad. So many people work in the capital. You know, okay, it's a bit of a unique problem to that part of the country, but for thousands of people, it's just absolutely miserable. And they're going to be facing train price rises next year for a service that doesn't work properly.
Govia, who runs Southern Rail, also run Gatwick Express. So it's tourists as well coming here. It's people trying to get
away. Well, I'll tell you one thing for nothing, Georgie. If I was a tourist and this was my first time coming into Britain and I was landing at Gatwick and I was getting on one of those trains and coming into London, I'd be like, why have I come to London on holiday? This is absolutely disgusting.
For the week pound, I imagine.
Well, for the week pound,
consult
great.
Yourself with some shopping.
But I tell you what, if you're stuck on that platform for 3 hours waiting for a train and you're thinking...
Pay for a taxi.
Well, yeah, nice, yeah. And then try and build the Southern for it. Yeah, nice. I just think it's a shambles. Yeah. And, you know, all of those train lines, actually, really. I mean, Heathrow Express is okay, but if you want to pay about 30 quid for it, you know, I mean, that's another thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You land at Heathrow, okay, you can get the tube, but if you want to get that express, I mean, it's so expensive. People must come here and think, what is this? This is a joke. When you compare it to the rest of Europe, how do the Italians run such a smooth system for such a cheap price. Every year there'll be like a week where we all question, like, oh, why train rides? But then it just seems to sort of fall away. Why? We need to do something, basically. The government needs to start looking at this and give us at least a freeze for a couple of years. That's my argument, anyway.
I don't know why I'm laughing, Lee. I'm a Southern Rail customer. Simon, what's the answer to this?
Well, Southern Govia also runs the Thames Link line as well, which is like one of the major lines. It's the one that runs from Bedford all the way down to Brighton. And they also now run the one that goes out through from St Pancras through Wellington City up that way mm-hmm. to Cambridge, all the way to Cambridge, I think. And what I think shows the complete failure of our privatisation of the rail system, and I'm not necessarily arguing that renationalisation is the answer, but the way that we privatised it was a complete failure. And I'm not sure that renationalisation isn't the answer, to be perfectly honest. I think I might be with Jeremy Corbyn on that one. But Govia is basically the company that used to run the Thames Link service until, I think it was around about 2005, when it was taken over by First Capital Connect, who swiftly earned themselves a moniker that used the word capital and inserted an R into it to make a word that you can think of. But Govia, I can't remember whether they were called Govia at the time or whether it was Go Ahead, which is basically part of Govia. They were actually barred from rebidding for that franchise. And then lo and behold, First Capital Connect, you know, leave after doing an appalling job as well. And that firm's back in charge running it and then also running Southern as well and making a mess of it. And one of the problems they've got, obviously, is that this is all about strikes because they're trying to cut back on staff. You know, there's an argument, are the people striking doing themselves any favours? You know, are they just building up public resentment? There's this whole thing around unionisation and strikes and all that kind of stuff that is a different thing. But basically, the problem is they don't have enough drivers because these guys are saying, well, hey, no, the staff are going on strike. But because of the fragmentation of the rail industry, they can't get in other drivers from elsewhere. It takes time to train a train driver. But when we had one big national rail service, you've got a problem in one part of it, you just get some drivers in from the other part of it. But now, if they want to get drivers in from another part of it, they'd have to be going and asking one of their rival companies, can we borrow some of your drivers? Mm. Which probably, unsurprisingly, those rival companies aren't too keen to be lending out their drivers to someone who is seen as the competition. And we see prices rise every year. And with these private companies, the prices are rising, the money's not going back into the service, and instead it's being paid out as dividends to shareholders. And I think, basically, you know, the cost of trains in this country is exorbitant, especially commuter trains. I think the service is appalling, and I think the system is clearly not working. And at the same time, what we're trying to do is actually give the rail service less money. So it's only going to get worse. If it continues on, it will only get worse.
Well, that's cheery, isn't it? Let's have some better news, slightly better news. The UK unemployment rate. We got that this week as well, didn't we, Simon? It held steady in the 3 months to June at 4.9%. The latest figures showing unemployment fell by 52,000 to 1.64 million between April and June. But to stick with the gloom and doom, experts suggesting this is just the lull before the storm will hit. Simon? Your views. Where are we? Pulling all this together, where are we headed? Can you tell from all these figures that we've got? And house prices will come up in a short while. We'll talk about that. But pulling all this together.
We're in the sun-drenched uplands of post-Brexit Britain, aren't we? Everything's fine. There's nothing to worry about. You can't read anything into these figures. It's so close to the actual vote. We saw a drop-off in sentiment before the vote, and we've seen a drop-off in sentiment after it. I think the sentiment has been improved by after the initial complete lack of a plan, someone getting a grip and is ending up with a new prime minister and what potentially looks like a bit of a plan. I think there's a lot of eyes on what Philip Hammond now does come the autumn statement. Mm. But I think realistically, you're going to have to look at the figures that come out over the next year. We're not going to know the effect, good, bad, or not really any effect at all. Until a year's time. So trying to read too much into it doesn't help. But all we can see is just things remain steady. And if you listen to people on one side of the coin, they'll tell you that's because everything's fine. And if you listen to people on the other side of the coin, they'll tell you that that's just, as you said, the calm before the storm.
Indeed. Well, it seems shoppers are not holding back from spending on the high street. That's despite the results of the EU referendum. Retail sales, we're hearing, including fuel, rose 1.4% last month compared with June. It was boosted by good weather, we're hearing, with both clothing and footwear performing strongly. Joe Grice is from the Office for National Statistics, which compiles the figures.
This is the first hard data that we've had about activity in the UK economy since the referendum result. It does suggest that if many feared there was going to be a collapse in consumer confidence, that hasn't so far occurred.
So where are we heading as well? Well, we're also headed to the pub, Lee. Attendance is up 11%, we're hearing, for a second successful year. Is that it? Are we just not drowning our misery, but going shopping, retail therapy,
to
the pub?
It's been nice weather, isn't it? Everyone wants to sort of have a little pint after work, and all of that does is just boost that industry. Who doesn't want a nice pint?
Absolutely. In this hot weather, it's lovely, isn't it? But is this what we're saying? Can you say that the public are sort of a bit Brexited out? You know, what will be, will be. We'll still keep spending.
Well, exactly that. I mean, if you need to buy some new stuff, you go out and buy some new stuff, don't you? I wouldn't exactly go, I'm not going to buy that because of Brexit. I mean, that's. But sometimes that's what I think has happened the last couple of months, and it's quite difficult when people are linking things like this to Brexit. Mm. Okay, I understand that confidence might have dipped a little bit, but it hasn't. People are still going out there, still hitting the shop. Are still hitting the pubs. Funny enough, the whole country hasn't just fallen apart. And actually, I reckon a little bit of, there's a bit of the Euros probably in that. You know, the Euros were on, so people were going to the pub watching that, even though England didn't perform particularly well. But the home nations were in Euro, so Wales were in it, and they got quite far. So that probably, I reckon it was quite a concentration of...
a regional breakdown here.
10% of that 11% were probably Welsh bound. But I just think, as Simon says, in terms of linking things to Brexit, you have to look in a year's time at what all of this, what picture this paints, because at the moment... It's just all this data becomes quite, dated. I know that this one is after Brexit. So I think a lot of it is just down to the weather. As Howard Archer described it, as sizzling. So sizzling summer. And if it keeps going for another month, then, I'm going to predict, funny enough, people want to go to the pub more and we'll probably spend. Feel good factor.
Could I just point out that the weather has been mediocre at best.
A couple of really hot days.
I love the fact that basically we haven't even managed to string more than two sunny hot days together
before
the thick band of grey cloud comes back in, and we're describing it as a sizzling summer.
Sizzling.
However, Lee has got a very good point there, and I've never understood why shops don't quite grasp this and start selling you their autumn clothes round about now. People buy things when they need them, and basically, if the sun's shining, they realise they need a pair of shorts and they go buy a pair of shorts. What they do not want is an autumn coat. So any shop's trying to sell you an autumn coat now, stop doing it. Sell people shorts. But people don't not buy shorts because of Brexit. I bought a sofa. Not because of Brexit, and not because of Brexit, not because I wanted to do my bit for the economy, but because I finally decided that 10 years after we last bought a sofa, it was time to buy a new one. But, on aggregate, over the course of the next year, will as many people buy sofas? That's the thing to watch.
That is the question. Indeed. Keep an eye on that one. That's editor Simon Lambert, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce from This Is Money, live in the studio. Now, one area I do want to continue with, having said all that about blaming everything on Brexit and stats from Brexit, we're going to talk property prices. And despite all the gloomy predictions, yes, they're holding up. Kel's surprise in the wake of the Brexit vote. The ONS figures out this week also show the annual rate of UK house price inflation rose 8.7% in June, seeing their biggest annual increase since 2014. John Hawksworth is PricewaterhouseCoopers' chief economist.
Well, I think before the referendum, I think people were probably largely assuming that the vote would be to remain. I think incomes were still rising, interest rates are very low, and there was an excess demand for housing because supply is quite limited. So I think all of those factors were tending to keep house prices strong, not just the last few months, but the last few years.
So where is going up the most? Well, according to the ONS figures, Luton and this place.
Come, friendly bombs, and fall on Slough. It isn't fit for humans now. There isn't grass to graze a cow. Swarm over, death. Come, bombs, and blow to smithereens those air-conditioned bright canteens. Tin fruit, tin meat, tin milk, tin beans.
Yes, John Betjeman's despised Slough up 24%. 6%, Luton 21.8%. 8%. What's going on?
Well, I tell you, Simon is the Luton expert, having lived there for a long time. But what I would say is the fact that the property prices in places like Luton and Slough were quite low for somewhere that's so commutable into London. People are looking where they can actually afford to buy, and probably Luton and Slough are up there, and they're looking, well, I can either buy in Luton or I can buy in a town nearby and probably get much more bang for the buck. That's what I would guess is happening.
Simon is the resident Luton expert.
I would just like to point out here that I never lived in Luton.
Oh, right.
I grew up near Luton. In Hertfordshire, okay? And I'm a Watford fan, and I never lived in Luton. I did work in Luton, though, for 3 years.
Oh, right.
On the local newspaper. I never lived there. So, Watford fan, it's quite important.
Got it.
You should know that bit, Georgie.
I know that much.
So, look, it is. It's cheaper than a lot of the surrounding areas. It's, you know, it's not a bad town. There's some not so great bits, there's some good bits, but some parts of it are very nice. But, you know, one of the key things is that, yes, if you compare property there to wages, it is still expensive. It is still probably as expensive as it's ever been, or as close to being as expensive as it's ever been. But it's an awful lot cheaper than many of the surrounding areas, and it's a 30-minute train ride from London. Mm. So, yeah, people are going Luton. And again, classic example, Slough. Same is true. I don't know so much about Slough, having also never lived in Slough.
I'm sure Lee will tell you.
I can list all the places I've never lived in if you like. But I think the same is true of Slough. I mean, actually, the biggest riser was somewhere in the Western Isles of Scotland, but I think that's probably skewed by the very small number of properties that were sold there. Mm. And the one after Slough and Luton was Newham in East London. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, property there compared to wages, expensive, probably as expensive as it's ever been, but cheaper than most of the other areas surrounding it and fairly close to central London.
More generally, I know we discussed it, but given the housing crisis, are you surprised by the fact that people are saying that actually house prices are holding up anyway in the wake of Brexit vote?
I think there will come a point where they are no longer affordable, where even, you know, the affordability is stretched so far that people simply cannot afford to buy them unless their wages go up. I think that there's been a lot of people sitting on their hands, and we talked about this the other day, surrounding, you know, people who were worried that, because people kept telling them that Brexit was going to make house prices fall, understandably they didn't buy houses. In some areas, it's still as hot as ever. In some areas, it's difficult to sell. The place where it's really hitting the market, if you talk to agents, is expensive homes. The sort of 750 grand plus properties, especially once you start getting up above £900,000, where you start paying more stamp duty, there's an extra thing that comes into play, which is you're paying so much money in stamp duty. If you buy £1 million house, you're basically paying more than 40 grand in stamp duty, I think. Mm. And you don't want to do that more than once, probably in your lifetime. So people are holding on, whereas I think maybe in the past, when the cost of moving was lower, when houses were cheaper and things like that, people would move a bit more speculatively.
Well, this all leads on rather nicely to something you've been looking at on your website. Due to rising house prices and higher stamp duty costs, the practice of a secret estate agent is rising. Tell us a little bit more about using a buying agent. Didn't that used to be the preserve of the rich and famous? Now is everybody at it?
The biggest falls, actually, interestingly, Simon says that, were in Kensington and Chelsea, which is the most expensive place to buy in Britain. And they saw house prices fall 6.2% in that annual index. So that's some telltale signs there. If the top of the market starts to crumble, it might start having a bit of a ripple effect. In terms of secret estate agents, a lot of people do kind of like to use a buying agent, and especially in the world of the internet now. You know, if you're selling a house that's worth £300,000, you do want everyone to kind of see it online. You know, most people now start their search online. But there are some people that want a bit of privacy. They don't want all their neighbours to see snoop inside their home. And some of these buying agents, you know, if you've got a bit of cash, they're probably worth their weight in gold, I suspect, because they can get ahead of the curve. You know, they know, they'll have contacts. I know when properties are going up for sale, ahead of sort of anyone else. And if you're looking to buy a high-end property or somewhere pretty fast, you know, they're going to be on the ball and probably get you a viewing before anyone else. And potentially buying that property sort of straight away. So that's the main reason that sort of, you know, richer people may use them, may not use them. But there has been a bit of a rise, I believe, in people just using them genuinely. And I think probably it's a bit of a London bubble in that effect, in the fact that properties are going up for sale. Maybe not so much now, you know, with the Brexit uncertainty, but especially at the start of the year, last year, properties in London are going up for sale, and you're reading about 20, 30 bids on them, people like literally lining up to go and have a look around a house. So, you know, secret estate agent might be a good idea for you.
A buying agent will tell you that they will save you more money than you will pay them. So that's one of the selling points.
Mm-hmm.
They'll also tell you...
I'm sure they can tell you anything they want to, but
yeah,
is that true?
Yeah, tell you anything they want. But I think in some cases it is true. So they'll basically talk to you. They'll find out exactly what you want. So you'll tell them the kind of property that you want. They'll then go off. They'll have contacts in estate agents, but they'll have contacts in estate agents who know people who might have thought of selling, but they don't really want to put their house on the market. They'll have contacts with people who they just know might be up for selling. And they can go hunt down that exact house that you want. They can try and match it as best as you want. But then they can negotiate hard because they'll argue that they know what that house is worth. They know the property market. They know it much better than you. They're much better at negotiating than you. They've also made sure that you've got all of your things in order so that you are basically a great prospective buyer. They come in and they say, we do this deal. This person will buy this house. Their mortgage is sorted, they've got the deposit, they're going to go through with it, it's their perfect house. And what people really want when they're selling a house is basically just to make sure that the whole damn thing goes through.
Mm.
And a buying agent will do that. And then again, you know, like I said, where would be my perfect place to live? I'd quite like a nice big house with a large garden, runs down to the Thames, I could keep my boat at the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. How do you find those places? Especially when the level of transactions is really low. Well, they'll tell you that they're their special man who's there to go out and help you. Although I must say that this is something that's been going on for years, because I reckon one of the first stories I ever wrote for This Is Money 10 years ago was about how more people were using buying agents.
And how do you find those places, Simon? Well, you go to the men who know. Lee, your time has come at last. Take off your This Is Money hat and put on your one gifted you from the Essex Tourism Board. We've been looking at where the happiest places are to live in the UK, and top of the list...
Oh, I do like to be beside the seaside. Oh, I do like to be beside the sea. I do like to stroll upon the prom, 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 where the brass band plays tiddly om.
Now, Lee, you admitted to us once a childhood dream of being an estate agent, didn't you?
You've never let
show.
That go, have you?
No. I still can't believe it, you see, Lee. I still can't believe it. So sell me Leon C.
Oh, it's an absolutely wonderful place to live. It's a good place for families, and it's a good place for commuters as well. Actually, that train line is pretty well maintained, and it's pretty well invested in. So, I mean, that's probably why a lot of people are happy, because they can actually get to work on time. But it's got a lot going for it. I live up the road. I actually got priced out of buying in Leon C recently, because it has become a bit of its own local bubble. But you still get far more for your money than you would in London. But it's got a bit of an independent vibe to it. It's a bit like I would describe it as a mini Brighton. You know, it's got the independent shops. It's got, you know, some nice restaurants. It's got a bit of town called Old Lee, which has all the sort of old world pubs. It's got the Cockles and all of that stuff that people really like to come down to the town for. And there's some good schools in the area. And it's a real scramble to find a property there at the moment, because a lot of people are moving down from London. People that may have been down there on a day trip and decided, actually, I want to live by the sea. It's very nice. I wouldn't say the sea views are particularly picturesque, looking over to the banks of Kent. But even still, it's still nice to be by the water. And it's getting quite a bit of investment. And now I absolutely hate mentioning The Only Way Is Essex. It makes me really angry, the television programme. But one of the guys from that programme has bought an old iconic hotel there. It's been in disrepair for a very long time. And it's a very nice old property, and what he's doing to it looks quite nice. He's turning it into a bit of a boutique hotel. So, again, that's probably going to help the image of the area a little bit more. And it's a very pleasant place to go. The one thing I will say, parking.
Oh,
if you've got a property and it's got a parking space, fine. Just don't expect visitors. I couldn't go and see my friends in Leon C and drive there. It's crazy. At the weekend, it's just a lack of parking spaces. It gets you a little bit angry. But if you live there and you've got a parking space, it's fine. You'll be happy.
OK, well, I'm sold. I don't have a car, so I'm sold on that. But what makes a happy place, though, I want to know?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would say a real mix of things.
This survey does. What does this...
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's a bit of a mix of community feel, local services and amenities. And that's what scored highly in this. So I think it actually came first for community spirit.
No, that was Stanford Le Hope.
Stanford Le Hope is actually up the road, which is a bit of a strange one. But
no, it came first for sports and recreational activities.
That's right. That's right. So you've got the 2012 Olympic mountain bike track just on the outskirts of Leith. So maybe people are enjoying going there and having a cycle along the seafront. Arts and culture. It's got a good independent art scene, actually. So that's probably why it scored highly on that. Opportunities to develop skills, well, as I touched on, good schools and restaurants and pubs. I mean, would I put that number one in the whole of the country for having restaurants and pubs? Probably not, but for the area, it's pretty nice.
I went through this. It's got 100 happiest places in the country, and I've lived or worked in 17 of those.
Wow.
And I put Bristol at number one, my old alma mater. Thank you very much, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce, Editor Simon Lambert from This Is Money.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.